But we have national issues, and NBA certainly has agenda, and most of our agenda is overseen and supported by our membership. Today, my boss, Senior Vice President of Operations, Steve Brown, is going to sort of give you an overview of NBA's issues and, I think, real-time issues.
Thanks, Dan. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. And as you probably saw on your program, our president, Ed Bolin, planned to be here, so I'm pinch hitting for him today. All of us are getting a bit older, and he was playing tennis recently. The ball and racket went one way, and his knee went the other. And so he's seeing a surgeon who's putting cameras in there and figuring out what to do with his knee. So, but I'm very happy to be pinch hitting him for him here today in a beautiful place. And I'm going to really try and tie together a number of things that Chris Farrell and Dr. Magadino pointed out with regard to some of the current issues we're facing in California and some of what the association is trying to do to improve what we face in the state, and then talk about some larger issues nationally, as Dan pointed out. You know, in Southern California, there's a lot of pressure, as we've heard, on the airport infrastructure, a lot of community activity in terms of growth and their point of view about growth, whether it relates to emissions or noise or land use or other aspects that control the public dialogue related to airports. And so we're very active in Van Nuys, Santa Monica, Burbank, and we'll have to become more active as the years go by in other places. These airports in particular are also very high-profile airports in terms of federal policy that's evolving on airports as well. In particular at Burbank and Van Nuys, there's a federal process underway called a Part 161 process. People who live inside Washington know about what that is. In essence, it's a formal federal process to study the noise impacts and, to an extent, land use and other aspects of airport development in a very structured way with state and local government involvement. It also involves the community as well as the users of the airport. It involves economic assessment, surveys, and a lot of outreach to both users and non-users of the airport itself. So it's a lengthy process. One of these studies is typically a couple of years in development. The length of the study process is largely controlled more by local politics than anything else, but to an extent, federal standards get involved as well. So both Burbank and Van Nuys are engaged in that Part 161 process at this point, and we, along with our members, are becoming more and more engaged as the issues mature and as the economic impact studies are done. One of the things that's very important for us in the aviation community and in the association is that if you're a user of those airports, it's very important you stay involved in the surveys that are done, indicating how you use the airport, what growth plans you might have for utilizing the airport, because all of that is factored in to the public policy that in terms of the federal approach and the state approach that's taken in terms of growth initiatives or potential limitations on growth at the airports. So at Burbank, for instance, just over the course of the next week or so, we're going to be engaging in a survey process of all of the users of the airport. And so if you're a part of that, I hope you'll talk to Dan and I about that because we'd like to involve you in it. Shortly after that, we'll be doing the same thing at Van Nuys. And frankly, this whole Part 161 effort also involves LAX, and to a certain extent we'll be involved there, even though we have fewer operators, obviously, than the commercial carriers do at LAX itself. So a lot of intense scrutiny of these airports and a lot of federal oversight is underway in terms of the future growth and development and ultimately our access to those Southern California airports. These airports, from a national perspective, I think as many of you would appreciate, are as important as the critical East Coast airports like White Plains or Teterboro. It really is where business aviation on both coasts predominates and seeks to and be involved economically in the development of state and regional economies. So these are critical national assets. The FAA sees them as such on a national level as well as a local level. And, of course, Chris has already pointed out how important they are to the state as well. So if you are users of these airports, I hope you'll stay engaged with us. We'll be doing outreach. Dan, our Western Regional Representative, is here all the time. and we'll be supplementing what he's doing with our national staff back in Washington in trying to protect and defend those airports. In the Central Valley, there's a block of military airspace that's very important also to the U.S. military called Lemoore MOA, and there's been a multi-year process underway to expand Lemoore, which would have an impact on all of the airspace users, whether it's the commercial airlines, ourselves, the lower end of general aviation. And the military use of that airspace has been formally proposed to change so that there's a lot more activity in the airspace and that both higher and lower altitudes are used more actively than they've been used in the past for a different training profile for those military operations. So certainly all of us want the military to have places to operate and do the exercises that are necessary as a part of the defense of the country. But we obviously want it also to be done in a way that's compatible with civil use and doesn't necessarily penalize civil operations if it can be avoided. All of that comes to a head, again, at FAA. This is one of the things that I used to work on when I oversaw the air traffic organization for FAA years ago, and it's one of those very difficult things to balance. There's a military needed imperative. There's clearly, if you go all the way in the direction of the military, an economic and operational penalty to the civil users. And so we've been involved as an association with the military and with other associations in trying to balance those competing interests at Lemoore. It's now at the point where it's almost on the administrator's desk for a final decision. All the environmental studies have been done. All the economic assessments have been done. All the advocacy groups like ourselves have weighed in. And so we think in the next couple of weeks, or certainly in the next couple of months, we'll see a final decision on Lemoore that hopefully will strike a workable balance between the needs of all the users, but one we've been very involved in as well. Further up the coast in the Seattle area, Boeing Field is possibly going to undergo some changes. A lot of growth at Boeing Field, very important business aviation airport. But, of course, SeaTac, the primary air carrier airport, is experiencing growth as well, is going to add a runway here in the not-too-distant future. And actually, the Port Authority of Seattle is thinking of taking over Boeing Field and operating it in addition to SeaTac, which is the primary airport that it operates. So there's a lot of local government conversation about whether the port should acquire Boeing Field and should begin to operate that in addition to operating the primary air carrier airport. Some of you may know that about a year or so ago, Southwest Airlines was on a campaign to try and go into Boeing Field, indicating that they thought the SeaTac prices were too high. So part of that's behind all of this discussion in terms of what the future operating parameters for Boeing Field should be. So again, Dan here locally on the West Coast with our local and regional groups that we have of our members in the Seattle area are now engaged in that dialogue. And we're starting a regional airspace dialogue with the FAA on what the impacts to the Boeing Field airspace would be if the port took over and what kind of modifications would be necessary to protect general aviation operations at Boeing Field. So a lot of technical work just beginning there in the Seattle area. And again, if you're a heavy user of that airport, we'd certainly like to stay in touch with you. Another item that relates to safety that I'd like to quickly touch on are what is an initiative that FAA has underway out of its airports division to enforce what are called RSAs, or runway safety areas. Chris Farrell touched on this a little bit in terms of land use, but the FAA also has specific technical criteria for overrun areas on runways to try and make them as safe as possible and to contain any unplanned events to the greatest possible extent on the airport rather than off the airport. And that's what runway safety areas are really designed for. They're safety areas that are not meant to be used primarily for takeoff and landing. We think of them as buffer zones. And many of the general aviation airports around the country are technically not in compliance with the RSA specifications. Well, FAA, for various reasons that I won't go into here because it'll give you a headache, is trying to enforce more compliance with these runway safety areas. And so what that nominally means typically is the runway becomes shorter in order to expand the buffer area. There are some limited cases, and Stuart, Florida is a classic case where we're actively engaged because we need to be involved in the setting of favorable precedent, where sometimes you can acquire additional land around the airport and use that as a buffer instead of making the runway itself smaller. And obviously that's the solution that we favor over making the runway shorter. And so ultimately we're trying to prevail in this case in Stuart, Florida, for additional land acquisition where that's possible and set favorable precedent to do that rather than going in the other direction. Overall, FAA is also focused on another initiative recently that they've really stepped up to in the last year or so, and that's a safety management system approach, not only to aviation operators like many of you in the room, but also the airport environment itself, and applying that kind of safety management discipline to the way that they look at operations on the surface at an airport. And some of that will also have impacts on the size of the runway that's available to use at an airport. So there are a number of different policy directions at FAA now that are putting downward pressure on the total size of a runway that can be utilized at an airport. And of course, the smaller the runway, the smaller the aircraft that can ultimately utilize the airport, and it results naturally in an access restriction for many different types of operations. So what we're trying to do is connect the dots for FAA. I can tell you, amazingly enough, having worked there, I can tell you firsthand that what the airports division has is a policy initiative with regard to RSAs, or what the flight standards division has is an initiative related to SMS approaches, or what the security group has with initiatives in terms of the runways and the ramp areas is not all coordinated at the top of FAA. And so part of what we do as an association is go to the agency and say, to the administrator, do you realize that there are actually four different parts of FAA that are all conspiring to make runways shorter, less usable, and generate less access for the users of the airspace? And usually the administrator will say, well, no, I didn't know that. And so one of the things that we try and do in Washington is connect those dots and help inform the policymakers that all of these things can work in a counterproductive way if they aren't looked at from a policy level as an entire whole and the impact that it has on a local airport, because often they're just seen as separate rifle shot initiatives that high-level policymakers aren't really aware of. And so we're trying to bring all that together and obviously want you in the community to know that these pressures are coming to bear as well. So beyond these local issues on the West Coast or in California, I thought I'd touch on and give you a little bit of an update on the national issue of user fees. Hopefully all of you have heard about the sort of drumbeat, the smoke signals that are in the distance, that user fees are likely to be proposed for business aviation operators with the president's next budget that will come out in February. And, of course, the elections have occurred. Congress has gone Democratic instead of Republican. There will be a different political dynamic that's in play. But frankly, it isn't going to change the fact that the administration, which of course is headed by the president and the Republican Party, actually proposes the budget and all of the policy initiatives that they believe should go along with implementing the budget. And that's what the FAA reauthorization bill is about. It's about funding the FAA and its future budget limitations. So what we expect will happen is the administration, the Republicans in this case, will propose direct user fees for general aviation in the coming budget, which will come out in February. And our best intelligence indicates that the form that that user fee will probably take is some kind of a fee for the time and system that an aircraft is, so maybe by hours en route or miles en route, some sort of a measure like that. And it would also propose additional fees for use of the terminal airspace, or you could think of that as landing fees or access fees when you utilize a tower-controlled airport. And you would pay an additional specific fee for landing at a tower-controlled airport. General aviation is completely united behind an approach that favors retention of fuel taxes as the proper way to pay for our use of the system. Because it is a surrogate for use of the system, obviously the more you fly in the system, the more fuel you burn, therefore the more tax you pay, and so it is a fair way to assess general aviation's use of the system. It's also efficient because you can't avoid the tax. Every time you buy a gallon of gas, you pay the tax, so avoidance is almost impossible. There's no bureaucracy required to send you an invoice, so it's everything that's collected actually goes to fund the FAA and the modernization of the airspace system, and none of it is raked off just for the purposes of generating invoices and paying bills and all of the inefficiencies associated with that. So that basically is all going to come to a head when the president's budget comes out in February. And lastly, I think many of you are probably aware of our website element that contains a Contact Congress resource, a mechanism by which you can click on an icon like this at our website and communicate with your elected representatives in Congress, be they Democrat or Republican, and let them know what you think about any of these issues. The little secret, by the way, is that this web portal Contact Congress resource works for any issue that you'd actually want to write your elected representatives about. So if there was something you wanted to write to them about with regard to health care, you could actually do it through our website. We don't encourage that. We'd like you to stay on aviation issues if you would. But what it essentially does is provide a direct linkage into the elected member's email system. You don't have to even know your elected representative's name. You know, we'll have a menu up there, and we'll have guidance for you using zip codes or other mechanisms so that you can actually figure out who your elected representative is. It'll automatically put the proper address in there for you. And there are some suggested letters in there on user fees or other issues that the association's involved in. So it's a very easy, user-friendly way to actually go in and send a communication to your elected representative. And you don't have to use the form letters that are in there. You can, if you'd like to, you can use the opening paragraph, and then you can put all your own words in there and send it off to your elected representative. So we hope you'll utilize this, certainly as these issues heat up. It's a great, simple way to get information into your elected representative. We highly encourage you to send letters to your member of Congress on either a company letterhead or personal letterhead. But I've got to tell you that after 9/11, not a lot of paper mail actually gets to your elected representatives anymore. Most all of it goes off to a very small place in West Virginia in the mountains, is irradiated, and all kinds of things are done to it. And it might get there 2 or 3 months after you actually sent it. So the way that you really get information to your elected representatives now is through electronic means and through websites and email like this. And so that's why we set this up for our members' use, and hopefully you'll find this to be a great way to communicate with your elected representatives. Again, thanks for being here today. I look forward to talking to you all individually if you have questions, but I'll turn it back over to Dan for his final comments. Thanks again.